Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks.
I'm Jonathan Braswell.
And we are here to talk about a new special edition 25th anniversary 4K Steelbook release of Event Horizon. Now, people will know if you've listened to this show and my opinions on science fiction, fantasy, horror, action, you will know that I have issues with the movie Event Horizon. I saw this movie when it opened in theaters 25 years ago now. Oh my God. And I went into the theater anticipating greatness. Me and my friend Sean, we went to see this movie. We were eager to see this movie. The trailers looked amazing. The visual effects that we could see on TV at the time looked stunning. We sat in a theater watching this film on the big screen. And halfway through the movie, I kid you not, halfway through the movie, I whispered to him, "My God, this is shaping up to be better than Alien for a sci-fi horror mashup." And he says, "Oh, I can't wait to see how they pull this in." And then the ending happened, and I could have kicked a room full of puppies. I am a dog person. And I was so angry, I wanted to punch kindergartners in the face. I wanted to punch anybody in the face. It was horrible. I was so disappointed. I was so angry at the epic story closure fail that happened with this movie. And as you can tell, 25 years later, I'm still salty about it.
Yeah. Oh. Well, I'm going to do what I can to, you know, help you out of that. But and I don't know what powers of persuasion I have, but we'll see what we can do.
Well, you intrigued me by saying that you liked the movie, you enjoyed the movie. And I have found out over the past 5 years or so that this movie is now considered a cult classic. I'm like,
yeah,
wow, standards have really fallen while I was away. What in the world?
Well, there's a group of movies, although people now watch, you know, most of their stuff on streaming and they choose when, you know, they want to watch stuff. There was a time, you may be familiar, where most people were getting their entertainment from what they rented, what they purchased in terms of DVDs, and then you had cable. And so cable will, you know, they have their programming departments and they put on what they think people should watch based on, you know, their ad spending or whatnot.
Uh-huh.
So sometimes, you're sitting around cleaning your house and they put on a movie and you think, yeah, I could watch that. So Event Horizon is in that pantheon of movies where you're kind of always up to watch it casually because it's got enough good stuff and it moves along well enough. And you kind of like the story. You're not really focusing on issues that may pop up about the movie. It's a good production and you roll with it. So it's firmly in that category for me, for many other people. And there are other elements about the production and the talent that are involved that I think put it over the top and give it that cult status.
Okay. Now, I remember when TBS would run the same movie back to back 3 weekends in a row.
Yeah.
Beastmaster, Lady Hawk, that sort of movie.
Mm-hmm.
I can understand how those get cult status.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I will be fair. I will be harsh but fair with Event Horizon. The acting in that movie is compelling. The set design is freakishly awesome. It is a stunning film to watch. It was shot with a great eye to detail and also to enhance the tension or the terror, depending on what's happening in the scene. As a crafted film, the movie is a success. I will even say that. As a completely coherent, well-told story.
No, sorry. And this is the mark. No.
It literally, who's the guy? Leon Lett fumbling the touchdown right before he crosses the line. That is an epic storytelling fail. The last 20 minutes of that movie veers violently. We're talking 90 degree turns at 100 miles an hour into WTF territory.
I can't really disagree. So what then you have to say is, you know, like a perhaps an ice skating competition, you know, the opening stuff was really good, and that is strong enough to carry, you know, a minor flub later on in the performance. There are a lot of good elements, you know, that run through the first two thirds of the movie that are strong enough.
The ending of that movie is not a minor flub.
No. I'm not talking about, let's put it this way. They happen in such quick succession that it seems to be, you know, there's a great politics quote about Tammany Hall that it was so corrupt, a sort of grandeur seeps into it. But it's very much like that. It's like a death of a thousand cuts in 20 minutes. Any one of those things would be bad, or, okay, you may be able to forgive it, but they happen so rapidly in that last block, which I think you're talking about, that it winds up being kind of like you just throw up your hands and ignore, you know, the first two thirds. I will say, if we're not saying it's talent and we're not saying it's the eye of the director, we're talking about the sensibility in terms of the writing of the director. And to be fair, although I like his work, I love his wife's work, Mila Jovovich, this is a fairly common enough reoccurring theme for Anderson in terms of films that start out strong and then something in the telling, the full telling and the closing of the story just misses. It goes off the rails and it becomes something that is kind of confusing versus the strong opening that he comes out with.
Yeah. And I will say that I learned from listening to a lot of the bonus features on this disc that Event Horizon was Paul Anderson's second movie. His first movie was Mortal Kombat.
Well, you know, let's not get into an argument about our sacred cows.
It's not an argument. It's not a sacred cow. Of Mortal Kombat holds a special place in my heart. Several of the background fighters who were in that movie were actually people I knew. Mm-hmm. So,
okay.
I have nothing against Mortal Kombat, but it's just that was his second movie to take on something of that scope in his second film.
Well, he had the sophomore curse, you know. There were some issues with, you know, the production. Stuff was shot and reshot. And you have to keep in mind, it seems to be, even now, a fresh film in many ways. But you are talking about a film that was released in 1997.
Mm-hmm.
So the problems that productions had and studios had and new directors had during that time, it makes some sense. There are really great ideas and great productions that were in the offing during that time that got lost in development hell because of a battle between the director and the studio, or because something didn't work right inside the production. So I'm being very generous by saying second film, sophomore curse, that period of time, I can't fault the production, or I can ding it on the ending, definitely, but I can't fault the production looking at all those other elements and the fact that his stories are almost universally really strong starters. I think what wound up happening is that somewhere along the way, creatively, there wasn't another eye looking at it saying, you've kind of written yourself into a corner here, or you need something fresh. Otherwise, it's going to fall apart.
Mm-hmm. Now, I will clarify. I will add my two cents.
Mm-hmm.
I struggled with whether or not to request this just because of how I feel about the movie. But I wanted to listen to the commentaries to see if there were any hints, any backstories in there that would explain that collapse.
Right.
And I'm going to say yes and no. First of all of the bonus features on the Blu-ray. This is a 4K. This is a Steelbook set. One disc 4K, one disc Blu-ray. The 4K disc has no extras whatsoever. It's just a movie in 4K. All of the extras are on the Blu-ray. And as it states, it is bonus legacy content.
Which Paramount put this out, yes?
Yes, this is directly from Paramount to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the release of this movie.
Can I just stick my dagger in between Paramount's ribs just for a second?
Sure.
Notoriously cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've had this discussion last time you had me on, so many moons ago, about me talking about the horror franchise properties they owned, having a huge vault of cut footage, additional stuff. Some stuff was released for books or anthologies or other productions, but the great majority of it is sitting in the quote-unquote vaults,
mm-hmm.
in addition to their Star Trek franchise properties. What they did with Generations and recycling costumes from other Star Trek productions, talent fighting over salaries and not getting what they were deserved after doing series. You know, we're talking about name actors, you know, third billing, second billing, people leaving shows because they weren't getting what they should have. Not even talking about what they should have been getting in terms of creatively, juicier roles, more screen time, better character development. So Paramount, really, historically now, we're talking since 88. So historically, 30 years or so at least, having some serious issues about being not just cheap, but short-sighted in terms of productions and taking care of talent.
I have a theory about that. I don't know if it holds true, but I think they got lazy. Because every time they released a new packaging, a new release of Star Trek, every Star Trek fan went out and got it. So they're like, hey, we can just throw, you know, anything. We can throw Synthahol on a disc and they'll buy it. And I think they just got, you know, a little complacent. But with Event Horizon, yeah, this movie literally came out almost exactly 25 years ago. August 15th, 1997 was the release date.
Mm-hmm.
The release date for this Steelbook set was August 9th. So it almost exactly
right
25 years. Now, one of the things that they said that I heard in the commentary was from the producer, Jeremy Bolt. And they were actually talking about some of the shot compositions in that ending. And there was more than once where Jeremy Bolt said, yeah, I was never really happy with the way that looked. And Paul Anderson would say, well, why didn't you tell me?
Well,
and it's like, you couldn't have told me then, you know? And it was, and you heard him say, you couldn't have told me that 8 years ago. And so I'm guessing that this commentary track was recorded for 2005 or 2006
mm-hmm.
release of Event Horizon.
Mm-hmm.
But I just thought that was hilarious because all of those comments about, you know, just literally offhand comments by the producer, Bolt, and Paul Anderson looking surprised going, dude. So I'm like, okay, one piece of the puzzle may have been solved. Something else that I did not know, they were filming at Pinewood Studios.
Right. Yep.
Which is, you know, the big studio lots where the James Bond movies are filmed.
Where they filmed parts of Star Wars as well.
Yeah. Apparently, that Burning Man sequence at the end where Sam Neill is on fire, they had an incident with the flamethrower.
Bout of flame, yes.
No. Yeah, they burnt down that one studio they were in. I'm like, you guys burnt down James Bond's studio for this crap? Really?
Well, look, I mean, you have to look at, you know, the time period. We're talking about a year. 1 year before Lawrence Fishburne makes his break into being, you know, leading man materials, you know, doing the
Mace. Yes. Event Horizon came out just a little under 2 years, like 18 months before The Matrix. Right.
And the kind of stuff that was going on at that point, a lot of science fiction, a lot of action, some good horror. So around this time period, you know, it's a good production, a really good production. There are, I will say, now that I'm thinking about it, there are glimpses of the story kind of crashing and burning, as you say, in the ending. There are little notes that you can see that in the writing and some of the pacing definitely shows you, if you're really seasoned and have an eagle eye, it'll telegraph to you that once this thing starts happening, and I'm looking at, you know, I looked at a copy last night and I'm kind of scanning it right now, you do see where things are about to start to, if you're a viewer, you start thinking, oh, I did sign on for this. This is going far differently than what it started as, which is a really solid, great, spooky, haunted house kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Haunted house in space. He actually says that in one of the making of documentaries, of which there are five. He says, you know, I wanted to do a haunted house in space. I, at this point, I have not gotten my answers as to why this fell apart to the point where it inspired great rage in me.
Well, I think there are a couple of things that might not have rung true to you. But ultimately, again, like I said, you have a finite list, your roster of characters, what you could do with them and how you can put them in different situations. Mm-hmm. You literally have two ships. You have this X factor, and then you have this main character who suddenly turns. There are a lot of elements in this that are very reminiscent of The Shining. I don't know how you felt about that, but the Kubrick version of The Shining, you have, you know, a main person who winds up going really insane, who seems to have been touched to be destined to be insane. You have an isolated situation, and you have one person trying to pull them and the people with them out of this situation. There's not very much space to take the story. Mm-hmm. There's not much air to burn. Within that, you see some really good character development. You see, what's the rescue tech names, the guy's name?
Richard T. Brooks.
He does an excellent job. I love the trope being turned on its ear, where you have, we talked about for years, people of color being in horror movies or this or that, and you're the first one to
get
blown apart and has, you know, a second act. he winds up rocketing back to the ship after drifting through space into debris of the Lewis and Clark.
And I totally forgot about that. So he actually flew like Iron Man before Mark Watney did.
It reminded me of the scene where he's running out of air and James Bond uses the oxygen tubes to rocket himself back up to the surface after the knife fight with the divers. You've got a really good dynamic in terms of the characters. People talk about character development and character building. You see all of that in the first 3 or 4 minutes. And the brilliance of that is because they're using the building blocks of exactly the movies in which people say it's reminiscent of.
Well,
you're talking
about
Alien. You're talking about Predator. You're
talking about that whole scene where they're waking everybody up out of stasis, and there's banter and, you know, interpersonal craziness going on. That's lifted directly from Aliens.
Exactly. So is the scene, the setting for the scene where he talks about the gravity drive and, and the reappearance of the Event Horizon. This is the kind of stuff that you're going to get from a sophomore effort, from a new director who is concerned with style and technique and nodding to things that are anchors in that genre that they're dipping their toe into. Consequently, you may get a terrible ending to the story or a truncated ending that doesn't seem fresh or very well thought out, but literally closes as you would expect kind of a haunted house movie to go. So to be fair, if Paramount didn't have a problem with it and they put it out there and the cult following likes it for what it is perhaps, as I originally mentioned, a very good popcorn movie, middle of the road, not groundbreaking, but with enough chops that it can be put in the same sentence in terms of mentioning other really great cinematic sci-fi horror productions.
And like I said, the one thing I would love to see is the original screenplay for Event Horizon that Paul Anderson latched onto and decided he wanted to make. Because I do believe that he made a lot of changes. He and the producers made a lot of changes to that script to fit the story.
Well,
because the original, I don't remember it now, but the original story was not horror.
What was it?
It was more action thriller. And then Paul Anderson changed it to horror because that's what he wanted to do. So I would love to see an original version, like not a first draft, but the sold version of the Event Horizon script that they decided this is the story we're going to make. And I had also looked up the screenwriter's name, Philip Eisner. He hasn't done a whole lot, but one of the things that he did was Firestarter Rekindled for Sci-Fi Channel.
I see.
And if I remember correctly, that was the one starring Marguerite Moreau and Malcolm McDowell.
Yes.
Which I actually kind of liked. I'm a Firestarter fan, just saying. I haven't seen the new one yet, but the book, Firestarter, was the first Stephen King novel that sucked me in and wouldn't let me go.
That's a good gateway drug to Stephen King. better than, I would say, something like Carrie or The Shining.
Mm-hmm.
That or The Running Man, I think, are good.
But yeah, Firestarter was the first novel, Stephen King novel, that totally hooked me. And the guy who wrote Event Horizon wrote the Sci-Fi Channel adaptation. The Sci-Fi Channel, I guess it would be a sequel since it was, you know, a more grown-up Charlie. Anyway.
Well, I will mitigate this by saying a couple things.
Mm-hmm.
One is that I think you're looking at the production versus who put together the production. And Anderson is a horror slash sci-fi slash action guy. Right, kind of in that order.
Right. But seeing what he was originally working with and extrapolating from what we have in the final movie to what he changed, we can maybe see where, you know, for lack of a better word, he drove the train onto some tracks that weren't the right gauge, and that's why it fell over.
Here's the thing. There is lost footage. Well, we'll put it this way. There existed lost footage.
Yes, there are.
Assembling a director's cut, but as one of the other vagaries of the production, a lot of that had been missing, and some of it was stored improperly, so a good deal of that footage was lost. There were also additional elements that were more fully explored in the film. Better explanation for Justin, Baby Bear, going into the black hole. A backstory between of a relationship between Stark and Miller.
Mm-hmm.
There was longer scenes of those that were interspersed when they are looking at the footage from the Event Horizon's journey into and hell.
Some of those are actually on this Blu-ray. They have I think it's one deleted scene and two extended scenes, and those scenes actually come with commentary from Anderson. And they have the concept art for some unfilmed stuff. And from what I'm seeing, and here's where we get into the, where are these other stuff? 2 years ago, Shout Factory came out with a Blu-ray collector's edition of Event Horizon that has like 10 new bonus features, at least 10, maybe 12,
Was that six. Footage or was it information?
This is all interviews.
Okay, so here's the thing. I'm pulling from an internet source, but apparently in an Event Horizon Q&A in 2011, when inquired about that extra footage and when it might be made available, Anderson said never. And a year later, the producer, Lloyd Levin, found a VHS tape of the original rough cut.
Oh.
So after finishing Resident Evil Retribution, the plan was to watch that recovered footage for the first time since the original putting together of the film. In 2017, he reiterated that a director's cut would probably never be released because the footage no longer existed. So when asked about the tape, he said neither he nor Levin or Levine, I could be wrong, had seen it, as Levine had moved to Spain. But Anderson said that he was excited about being able to watch it at some point. So
that sounds like a little tap dance. They have it, but they can't release it as a contiguous director's cut, but maybe that footage will show up later as bonus scenes. Maybe.
Possibly. Oh, and to help you out a little bit,
the
film's final ending was a combination of two unused alternate endings. So that confusion or cobbling together a Frankenstein-like ending might, you know, speak to part of what you're saying in terms of it falling apart at the end. But looking back at that last 20 minutes, the pacing was a little bit off. He does drop foreshadowing hints about Dr. Weir going through. But again, apologies to anyone who loved The Shining or Kubrick's version. There are elements there where the breadcrumbs are laid, but the spacing is a little odd. So when the reveal happens, feels a little rushed, feels a little, doesn't fit as well as it could have.
Some of what happened, it seemed like it came out of left field.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like, well, wait a minute. How did we get from where we were to here? What happened? What went on here? And there was never any explanation for that. And to be honest, the commentary track over the very, very end where they're rescued from the pod
mm-hmm.
makes everything else make total less sense. Apparently, the vision that Jolie Richardson's character,
Stark,
when they opened up her pod
mm-hmm.
and she's having this vision, she thinks she's rescued. She lifts up the helmet of the guy who's pulled her out, and we see Weir's disfigured face. And she starts screaming.
I think that was for the viewers to tie into his hallucination at the beginning of the film.
Oh, no. Oh, no, 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 no. It's worse than that. They said so in the commentary.
Oh, boy.
they cut back to her. She's freaking out she's got rescue personnel around her.
Mm-hmm.
Richard T. Jones's character comes out and he's like trying to hold her and like stop her from flailing around. And the commentary, Paul Anderson says, and this is supposed to indicate to the audience that the evil that was brought back by the Horizon, which infused itself in Dr. Weir, is now in her. And I'm like, pardon my French, what the absolute fuck does that have to do? How did, like, why? What are we supposed to pull from that? Why did the evil leave the ship and infest Dr. Weir? Why did it leave Dr. Weir and infest Miller? What was the point of that?
I don't think it got into Miller. I think.
No, he said so in the goddamn commentary.
Weir is an easier case to make.
Paul Anderson said this is supposed to show that the evil that infected Weir is now in Miller. Said it right there.
That's so odd. It would make more sense if he said, in fact, in terms of, you know, hallucinations and getting people to do whatever was in the ship. You know, like Peter's people mm-hmm. killing themselves. Right. That kind of thing. I get that.
The evil came back with her and it's going to do whatever through her. I'm like, what?
That doesn't
make sense. Thank you.
I don't really even know what the point of that would be. It would make more sense if it had been Coop. Coop was close to Justin. Coop, you know, had fought, you know, to get back to the ship. Or any of the other people that were killed who were just killed outright. It seems as if there were selective plans for everyone, which is kind of weird. And Weir, it makes the most sense for Weir because you've established the fact that he is distraught about losing his wife.
Yes, he's haunted
because of the work that he's done.
He's haunted by her death and the manner of her death.
Exactly. So
he is already carrying a well of darkness in him, which makes him more susceptible to whatever entity was infused in that.
Well, look, I look at it differently. I think mm-hmm. this is a character who, you know, is, it makes sense in the end, he knew who was going to die. And part of the reason why was because of his obsession and throwing himself into his work to such an extent that he let go of the rest of his life. That was the person who was going to be most affected fastest by this thing. Okay. You see it in his speech to the crew about his obsession at finding it, all the way through the process of the investigation, crew members starting to die, him trying to struggle with finding out. That wasn't a struggle to find out what was going on. That was him still letting go of all of the other ties that he had and being open to the ship seducing him in the form of his wife. It could have been just left with that, and he could have been the primary villain. I think Miller, to say that Miller was being infected really throws away all the hard work you've done in giving Miller the hallucinations, him talking to the other guy who passed away. It may have been DJ, might have been the other character, when he talks about his feeling of guilt, about his feeling of being unsettled as a commander because the ship seems to know things that he has never told anyone, and him unraveling as this character of authority and confidence and being able to get them out of this situation. Somebody really trying to get his crew home. So you throw away all that good work by saying this evil is infecting him. To what purpose? Why? It seems incredibly random, especially when you've put all these other tent poles, his wife being essentially damned and him being damned for pushing her to suicide. Very, you know, Dante-esque there. So it's unfortunate that you would put those things together and do all that work to then kind of cheapen it a bit by saying this nebulous cloud evil energy is just hopping from person to person. Mm-hmm. For what? To do what?
And here's where some of my confusion came in. This movie has successfully lifted elements from both Alien and Aliens. Who in their right mind, watching Dr. Weir's literal descent into madness, wouldn't have had Ash in their head from Alien?
Well,
ulterior motives.
Because it's very easy to see Fishburne as Dallas. You see that very early on when he's talking about, when he interrupts Weir and saying, you know, we don't appreciate being out here. His initial line about what's going on and why they're there sounds so much like Dallas talking to Veronica Cartwright in Alien. Mm. About, well, you know, you get what you're contracted for. When they're talking about calculations of getting the orb back, yeah, thrill me, why don't you? You know, almost like a middle management kind of guy. You know, you're top of the chain. You've got, you know, responsibility for the crew and ship, but there is a different thing. You're part of the crew, but you're different from the crew. I get that same feeling from him, from Fishburne in that role.
Okay.
But where you had a monster. The difference is that you had a singular monster, and Alien does something unique by distilling this down into a female hero, but as beginning, I think, the genre of, or contributing to the early part of the final girl thing, which you don't have in this other movie. It kind of evolves, but very little play is given to the fact that you have this man of color and this woman who wind up being the survivors, which is very cool.
And the guy in the coma.
And the guy in the coma, right. Who, through no fault of his own, got really busted up in this movie. But there are good elements that he's always aware of and that he puts in and get short shrift, not because he buries the lead, but because the rest of the material winds up sinking that into the rest of the film or whatever else is going on. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there was not much room to go. You're talking about a, you know, fairly standard horror story. You've got it looks really slick even now. We're talking 20 some plus years later. 25. It still looks good. Mm-hmm. It looks slick. And you get that little little bump when you get this feeling of this reminds me of Alien. This reminds me of this. This has this feel, this lived in feel. So much so that it is annoying, but not super annoying, that there are three sets of rhyming dialogue within 45 seconds. Very on the nose at somebody being an early director, that you didn't catch yourself before you wrote this, or the script supervision wasn't really quite there to say, this seems kind of like, this doesn't really work well. And so that's one of those foreshadowing things about things being written a certain way, things being plotted and paced a certain way, that if it had a little bit more control, it was a little bit more tightly looked at, there might have been something else that came.
I did not have my answers. I did not find my answers into why this fell apart. I am happy with the extras that were on here. Mm-hmm. I kind of wish I had enough interest in this movie to get the Shout Factory version to listen to all of the other interviews, because they interviewed everybody on that Shout Factory release. They interviewed Paul W.S. Anderson. They interviewed the writer, Philip Eisner. They interviewed the actors, Kathleen Quinlan, Jack Noseworthy, Peter Marinker. They interviewed the set designer, the production designer, the set decorator, everybody, the sound designer.
Did they get Fishburne?
They did not.
I don't think he ever does, except for The Matrix. He's not an extras kind of guy. Did they get Neil?
No.
Okay.
And the other extras are the same ones that are on this set.
Mm-hmm. I see.
The most interesting thing I found out is that they made a full body prosthetic of Jason Isaacs for when he was flayed open. And it was so lifelike. Like, it looked so much like him that he said he asked, could he keep it when they were done? And they just said, dude, no, that's creepy. We may need it later. So he never got it. He tried later to get it. He never got it. And he actually says, if anybody out there has this, call me. I'll buy it from you. And I'm like, that is dedication. That is a commitment to a movie prop. I can applaud that.
That was quite a gruesome bit of FX work,
right?
There was the you know what, thinking about this and talking about it now, I think I'm going to start referring to Event Horizon as the Space Shining, because there are a lot of blood coming from the walls, inserting people where they don't belong, the ending falls apart. Really good premise, good setup, spooky, even unsettling and disturbing to the core, good atmosphere.
Here's a question for you.
Go ahead.
Which scene of Dr. Weir's is most like, here's Johnny?
Do you see? Do you see? There you go. That's it. That's
the nice. Nice. Yeah. You're right.
Yeah, absolutely. It has... Interesting, that scene reminds me, in terms of the shots, reminds me a lot of V for Vendetta, when V breaks out and he's naked and there are flames behind him.
That reminds me
of that. So it has I like Anderson's eye, and that he touches on things, or other people touch on his work and expand it. So it's kind of like this quiet conversation that's being had from film to film to film. But he is very much, you're looking at somebody who is just starting out, who is essentially a populist actor, wants to entertain people, but has some knowledge and some chops about how to put things together. So looking at it in that context, this should be something that shouldn't piss you off so much and allow you to just, you know, go down a couple of floors and say, this is a really good popcorn movie. It's supposed to kind of spook me out. And then we go on from there. You know, it's a decent movie. It's a good movie.
I know.
That's not going to happen.
No, that's not going to happen. I still have an appreciation for, like you said, the set design, the production design, the sound design. Mm-hmm. There is a commitment and appreciation of craft that goes into building up the look and the sound of that movie.
Right.
I cannot fault that. It is pretty to look at. It is a visually appealing movie, especially when you're talking like space horrors. I just know my sense of faith in the storytelling was attacked in a back alley with a Louisville Slugger, and oh my God.
Instead of asking you what would you have done differently, maybe the question to ask is what you were expecting to see, how you're expecting that to be resolved. I don't see very many ways to get out of that situation. We're talking 20 minutes to the end. We're right at the point where...
And they mentioned that they were coming up against deadlines for shooting. And it just enhances the feeling that this was rushed and the attention to what should have been a satisfying close to a story. Yeah, leave it open-ended. Leave questions in there. Some of the best movies have that. What happened there? But they don't violate everything that's been built up beforehand.
Matrix, you do get that feeling. I do agree. You do get that feeling. You're like,
Matrix 3, I'm looking at you. But yeah, no, it's like they forgot to finish the story while they were trying to make sure they had all the shots to close out a loop, to close out an arc, but it didn't satisfy the story that was built up in the previous 70 minutes.
So you think at core, Weir was handled poorly because he drives the story.
It's not that he was handled poorly at the end. The concept that the ship traveled through a dimension of evil, which we are calling hell, in order to do this tesseract travel, this wormhole travel. Sure. What was he saying? You know, the shortest distance between two points is point A and point B, but what if they were here? And that question of when we, as finite human beings, begin to mess with concepts of physics, quantum mechanics, and other non-Euclidean
exotic materials.
Yes, exotic materials and exotic equations that we do not fully have a grasp on. I accept the hand-wavium of the science and technology that is being described there. The concept of what happened to the ship fell apart. Was the ship possessed? Was the ship itself? Did it become sentient? How did that sentience transfer itself from the ship to Dr. Weir, and why? And then, as we get at the end, why did it transfer to Miller?
And then to Stark, allegedly.
I think it didn't actually get to Miller because he actually did blow up everything, but it went to her. I'm like, what? You just fumbled the ball on that.
Well, that's a sticking point for me, but I think that maybe gets to explaining that a bit better. Something that comes out of hell is, it clearly seems to be totally embodied in that ship. Blowing it up doesn't send Miller to hell. He apparently just dies. So I think, as unknowable as it is, that's the question. It opens the question. As unknowable as it is, with the exception of the footage from the crew, to know where the event horizon went, it's just as unknowable to concretely quantify what it is now. So what you have is, in the best tradition of a ghost story, you have glimpses of the ghost, but more the onus is placed on the characters, how it impacts them, how they feel, how they interact with one another. And you are going through that as the character. The character is mirroring the audience. So I think they were quite content with keeping it nebulous and not explaining it. None of the great sci-fi or horror films really explain anything. They don't do anything much in terms of explaining aliens. Same way nothing is explained in Halloween, that it was supposed to be just like this killer. No backstory, no curse, no nothing that they did in subsequent films, just this thing.
But they didn't drop the ball with the ending of the story.
With Halloween, you mean?
With any of those, any of the ones you just mentioned.
Arguably, you could say Shining dropped the ball. The guy freezes in the snow. All right.
Yeah, but no, the other ones, it's like, yeah, there's stuff left unexplained because more than half of the universe we live in is unfathomable to us in our current state of consciousness.
That's why they left it open-ended.
Don't have the capacity
to understand,
to absorb it and describe it.
Right.
You know, so I get it.
Maybe it's a cop-out, but and giving people the popcorn that they want. You know, maybe there's something in there. Maybe there's opening to another sequel. Who knows what's going to happen? It keeps you in that feedback loop at the end of the film. Not necessarily to distract you from the fact that, you know, we really didn't have an ending, so here, take this.
No, seriously, my friend and I, we walked out of that movie angry as all get out at that ending. We were pissed.
It is unsatisfying. I will grant you that. But that's why you get the big scene of Miller blowing up the ship. So you get that payoff, and that is mostly satisfying. There's a really great episode of The Simpsons where this French guy is trying to seduce Marge, and he invites her out to brunch. And she says, "I don't know what brunch is." And he says, "It's not breakfast, it's not lunch, but you get a good meal." So this is brunch. It's not what you'd expect, but there are enough good things in it that you can say, all right, I don't hate all of it. And you didn't hate all of it. You hated the ending.
I hated the ending. Yeah. I will admit that freely. I was enjoying the thrill ride, the roller coaster ride, up until that ending.
It was good. There's one thing I don't like about TV shows or movies. I don't like bottle episodes where it's fixed, or there's a hostage episode, or there's a time limit episode. I don't really like those. And so halfway, three-fifths through the movie, it starts to feel like that. So even though, you know, the ending was what it was, I do like that they just broke out of okay, we have this amount of time and it's picking people off one by one. That gets very predictable and boring to me. So I do like how, you know, let's just slaughter everybody. It's very much something that's done now in films where people are very much throwaway because we find people are disposable in our modern age. So it's a little unsettling to see this happen so long ago. Yeah, granted.
Okay. Well, I think I have finally gotten most of what I wanted to say about this movie off my chest. I am glad that I requested this so I could take a look at it, see if my feelings on it had shifted or not. They hadn't. It's really funny. If you watched the like last 10 or 15 minutes or 15 or 20 minutes of this movie with the sound off,
it's a little disjointed.
You see more clearly what you were talking about earlier. But so this copy I have in my hand here of Event Horizon, the 4K, let me make sure I got it here, 4K Ultra HD plus Blu-ray plus digital code 25th anniversary edition is going to be something I'm going to be giving away. So sometime on Monday, I'm going to open up a raffle for this and people can submit to it. And I'm going to give it like 2 or 3 weeks. Let enough people listen to this. And if they want this copy of Event Horizon,
I will.
There are people who love this movie, and I have no problem whatsoever gifting this steelbook to one of those folks. And it is a pretty to look at set. I mean, the new artwork on the cover is creepy. It's creepifying. So if there are fans of Event Horizon out there who have not yet purchased their copy of the Steelbook, the price of which varies very widely online. I've seen it listed for $30. I've seen it listed for $75. I'm like, what? But this will be available, and we'll do a giveaway for it, and like I said, I have not changed my mind about how the ending makes me feel, but I am happy that I watched all of these extras because there were a couple of little tidbits in there that were enjoyable for me as a fan of commentaries and bonus features that I am.
To soften the blow, as it were.
Yes, yes. To give me something else entertaining to distract me from the ending. Whatever saves the puppies, right? So I would like to thank everybody for listening to this interesting episode, this special episode. If this sort of discussion interests you, let me know. You can call in your comment, the voicemail line, 602-635-6976, or shoot me an email, summer@sliceofscifi.com. Let me know. You can also come to the website, sliceofscifi.com, to leave your comment in the discussion section and get some conversations going. Quickly, you can listen to Slice of Sci-Fi on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Player FM, and iHeartRadio. And if you happen to be listening through Apple or Stitcher or Podchaser, please consider helping us out, leaving a rating or review. Let people know that you are enjoying the show and maybe they should check it out for themselves. Other places you can find us, sliceofscifi.net, where we are building a curated list of quality science fiction, horror, adventure, content.
Chef's kiss.
Yes. And those are all affiliate links over there, which help us out a little bit. You can contribute by donating through or pledging through Patreon or donating through Ko-fi or PayPal. If you go through Patreon, which is patreon.com/sliceofsci-fi, you are eligible for perks. And every month I pick a winner out of the hat. That person gets to pick from a Blu-ray, a 4K, a DVD, or a book, much like this copy of Event Horizon 25th Anniversary Edition. There's just some review materials I can't keep because I don't have the space, and some that I'm curious about but don't want to keep. Event Horizon. So go over there if you want to sign up for a monthly pledge, become eligible for perks, or if you just want to donate every now and then. The links to use are Ko-fi, ko-fi.com/sliceofscifi, or paypal.me/scifisummer. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you, Jonathan, for lending your insights to this discussion.
My triumphant recurrence.
Yay! Yes. And thank everybody else. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.